This is Talk of the Nation. I'm John Donvan in Washington. Romney rolls on Super Tuesday. Santorum stands his ground, and Gingrich plans the long, slow path to the nomination. It is Wednesday, and time for a...
I'm the tortoise.
...edition of the Political Junkie.
There you go again.
When I hear your new ideas, I'm reminded of that ad. Where's the beef?
Extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice.
Senator, you're no Jack Kennedy.
You don't have Nixon to kick around anymore.
Lipstick.
Oops.
But I'm the decider.
Every Wednesday, political junkie Ken Rudin joins us to recap the week in politics and what a week it's been. A big week, so we're going to take the entire hour on it today. Mitt Romney takes six states on Super Tuesday, including Ohio, the closest race and the most closely watched of the 10 contests on Super Tuesday. Rick Santorum grabs three of his own, while Newt Gingrich is now planning his own southern strategy after a win in his home state of Georgia. We are going to focus on all of Super Tuesday news in just a bit. Also this week, Rush Limbaugh ignites a controversy. Independent Angus King says he will run for Olympia Snowe's main Senate seat. Veteran Democrat Norm Dix announced his retirement. New polls show that the president is gaining ground and with strong support from Latinos. And we'll remember two people, journalist Andrew Breitbart and veteran Congressman Donald Payne. Later on in the hour, we will be speaking with Bloomberg Government's Rob Levinson about the politics of Israel and the ongoing APEC conference. But first, we begin, as we always do, with a trivia question. Ken?
Hi, Super. Happy Super Wednesday.
Thank you.
Hi, John. Okay, well, let's see. There's obviously a big win for Mitt Romney last night. He won six primaries and caucuses, so he got the most wins, the most delegates. So here's a Super Tuesday trivia question. There have been two times when, on Super Tuesday, one candidate won the most votes, but another candidate won the most delegates. The second time that happened was in 2008, when Hillary Clinton got the most votes, but Barack Obama won the most delegates. What was the other time?
This is not an impossible question?
It's not at all.
Because there's an answer.
There is. And there's a T-shirt in the making.
All right. If you think you know that answer, give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And as Ken just said, the winner gets that fabulous no prize T-shirt.
Just to review the question, just in case.
Yes.
On a Super Tuesday, one candidate got the most votes, but another candidate got the most delegates. It happened with Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama in 2008. It happened once before. What was that time?
How many Super Tuesdays have there been?
All of them.
All right.
Okay.
Ken, we want to get to this past Super Tuesday, yesterday's Super Tuesday, and move on to some. Before that, we're gonna actually look at things that happened in the week ahead. But before we get to the week ahead, just how super was Super Tuesday on the super scale?
Well, if the name of the game was Ohio and all the candidates were talking about Ohio, all the media were talking about Ohio, if Ohio was the name of the game, then it was a very good day for Mitt Romney. Not only did he win most of the primaries and caucuses, he won six out of the 10, but he won the big state, which was Ohio. And a week ago, Rick Santorum seemed to have a pretty sizable lead. Now, yes, Mitt Romney had all the endorsements. He outspent Santorum perhaps 4-1. In advertising. But again, if the name of the game was Ohio, that's the big win. But having lost in Tennessee and Oklahoma, as well as Georgia, Newt Gingrich in Georgia and North Dakota, Mitt Romney does show weaknesses with conservatives and evangelicals. And we've seen that the entire primary season. But the point is, he now has more delegates than all of his opponents combined. And he's more than a third of the way on the way to 1,144, the
all
magic number.
Well, we'll come back and dissect yesterday in a great deal more detail in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about the week that was. Let's begin with Rush Limbaugh's situation, his comments, his apologies, and how that's playing out politically.
Well, of course, everybody knows about this. This is a woman named Sandra Fluke who was talking about wanting insurance coverage for contraception. And Rush Limbaugh, as he's done in the past, went on and basically it was like a personal attack on her. Rather than talk about religious liberty, which was initially thought to be the issue, he did a personal attack on Sandra Fluke. He called her a slut, a prostitute, and he says, well, you know, if she wants government money for contraception, we want to be able to watch it or something in some video.
Right.
It was an awful, awful thing. The thing is, and he apologized, and perhaps he's apologizing because he's losing sponsors left and right. I mean, there's you know, at least two dozen so far sponsors who have left the Rush Limbaugh show. But it also comes at a time when the Republican Party is having trouble attracting the votes of women. It's, I mean, or at least it seems to be. The polls seem to indicate that, especially in their fight with over contraception. The Republican Party has always been split. There's always been the issue about abortion, and that's been going on for decades. But the thing over contraception seems to be a new battle, and it seems to, at least in the eyes of some pollsters, seems to be pushing away more and more women voters.
And President Obama got involved in this very quickly and called Sandra Fluke to express his support for her. But how has this played on the other side? I know that the Republican candidates were pressed on this, and did they step back from Rush quite significantly?
They did. I mean, they said that these are things, I think Mitt Romney's exact words were, this is not something I would have said. Rick Santorum was unhappy with it, too. You know, whenever, like Reverend Wright, whenever you'd have a controversy on the left, you'd always have President Obama or some Democrat having to defend it or not defend it. And that happens often with Rush Limbaugh, too. He'll say something incendiary and all the Republicans are going to have to defend it or not. And sometimes that scene is not fair, but sometimes it is fair. I remember when Rahm Emanuel was the chief of staff for President Obama, he always said that Rush Limbaugh was the poster boy or the public face of the Republican Party. And that may or may not be true, but there are a lot of Republicans who just quote Rush Limbaugh constantly and hold him up as some paragon of Republican values. And if that's the case, this certainly hurts the GOP.
Let's go as far northeast as we can now. Former governor of Maine, Angus King, is announcing he's going to run for Senate, taking the seat of
Olympia Snowe.
Trying to take the seat of.
Right. Now, this is a fascinating story because Maine is a very independent-minded state. This was when Ross Perot ran for president twice. Maine was his best state both times. As a matter of fact, in 1992, Ross Perot finished second. President George H.W. finished third. George Bush finished third in Maine. That's how independent Maine is. And, of course, Olympia Snowe, while a Republican, was a moderate, independent kind of Republican. Angus King was elected twice as governor in 1994, 1998. Is very, very popular. And he's a social liberal, but he's a pro-business candidate. As a matter of fact, he endorsed George W. Bush for president in 2000, although opposed him in later years. But anyway, so he's very in the middle, and the Democratic progressive candidate that the Democrats were pushing, Congresswoman Shelley Pingree, who was all set to announce today that she will not run. The feeling is that she and Angus King would split the non-Republican vote and allow the Republicans to win. So she backed out of the race today.
Let's see how we're doing on the trivia contest. Restate the question very quickly.
I have no idea what it was. No, it was, okay, in the history of Super Tuesdays, as we saw in 2008, Hillary Clinton got the most votes. Barack Obama got the most delegates. When was the first time a Super Tuesday occurred when one candidate got the most votes, another got the most delegates?
Let's see. David in Phoenix, Arizona. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Okay, I'm going to change my answer. What I told your producer, I said it was somebody else. I'm going to guess the first Super Tuesday, 76, so Walter Mondale, it was Gary Hart, won more delegates, but Walter Mondale got more votes.
Well, actually, it's not a bad guess, but no, Walter Mondale did get the most votes and the most delegates on Super Tuesday.
Okay.
All right. Thanks for trying. Jared in Plymouth, Massachusetts. You're on Talk of the Nation. Jared, you still there?
Yep, I'm still here.
What's your answer?
Was it Kerry and Edwards in 2004? Edwards getting the most votes and Kerry getting the most delegates?
No, matter of fact, I think, if memory serves, I think John Edwards only won his state of North Carolina in the entire South Carolina, in the entire primary system, and John Kerry basically cleaned up on Super Tuesday, won the most states, won the most votes, won the most delegates.
All right. Thanks for trying, Jared. Hi, Randy. You're in Madison, Wisconsin, and now you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yes, good afternoon. I was guessing what I thought was the first Super Tuesday, 1988.
And who are the candidates?
I believe that Gore won more states, but Dukakis won more delegates.
That is not that's not correct. As a matter of fact, Al Gore finished third in that year, both in votes and delegates.
All right, Randy, thanks for trying. And Paul in Tahoe, California. Hi, you're on Talk of the Nation. Paul, you there?
Paul, yeah.
Hi.
96, Dole and Kemp.
Well, actually, Kemp was his running mate in 96. Jack Kemp ran for president in 1988. Dole, but 1996 is the wrong answer. Bob Dole won the most votes and the most delegates.
All right, thank you.
Sorry, Paul. All right. Chris, San Francisco, California, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I'm going to go with 1988. Jesse Jackson getting the most Putnam votes and Dukakis the most delegates.
And that is the correct answer.
Oh, there should be a bell ringing.
Ding. To quote Neil Conan, ding, 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 ding. Jesse Jackson did have the most votes. Michael Dukakis, I believe, got three or four more delegates than Jesse Jackson on Super Tuesday 1988.
Chris, you get the T-shirt.
Jesse Jackson.
Jesse Jackson, yeah.
Congratulations, Chris. You do get the no prize T-shirt. Just stay on the line and we'll get you information, but congratulations to you. that was full-throated.
That sounded like Ron Paul last night. It didn't sound that exciting.
I'm amazed at the knowledge that comes out, even with the wrong guesses. I never ultimately expected it would get there. I want to talk about two more stories before we go to the break. Andrew Breitbart passed away.
Well, you know, there are some on the some conservatives who felt that this is, you know, he is the right's version of Abbie Hoffman and Jerry Rubin. He's a conservative provocateur. He certainly exposed a lot of things like Anthony Weiner. He's the guy who put up Anthony Weiner's internet pictures that led to the resignation of the liberal congressman from New York. And he loves tweeting liberal bias in the media, but at the same time, he had his own standards and his own ways. What he did to Shirley Sherrod by editing a video that made her sound racist. This is the former Agriculture Department person. So it sounded like, you know, he would make things out to be what they weren't. He was kind of loose with the facts. And so he had a mixed record, I think, as far as so-called journalism.
And Democrat Donald Payne also passed away.
Congressman from New Jersey, from Newark, New Jersey, elected in 1988, replacing Peter Odino, the state's first African-American congressman. He was 77 years old, died of colon cancer.
All right. Well, we're going to talk more with political junkie Ken Root in just a minute and sum up the results of yesterday's Super Tuesday primaries and what it might mean for the rest of the campaign. We have a question for you, our listeners. If you're in a state that has yet to vote in the Republican primaries, do the Super Tuesday results change anything for you? How do you read them? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. I'm John Donvan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm John Donvan. It's Wednesday, Political Junkie Day, and Ken Rudin is here as always. Ken, was there a winner in the Scuttlebutt puzzle last week?
It's funny you mentioned that. There absolutely was. The puzzle, by the way, I had in the middle of it, I had two Udall for President buttons, so it was part of St. Elmo's Fire. Oh. Yeah, okay. Mo Udall, mm-hmm. One of the Three Stooges. And the winner was Jin Peck of Phelps, New York, and she gets a T-shirt.
Congratulations, Jin Peck. So we're going to give them an official no-prize T-shirt, and you can try your hand at this week's Scuttle Button and read his latest political junkie column at npr.org/junkie. That is Ken Rudin. So, Ken, 10 states voted yesterday on Super Tuesday. Here's how it breaks down. Mitt Romney took 6 states. Rick Santorum won 3. Newt Gingrich is hoping that his singled win in Georgia will help revive his campaign. Ron Paul came up yesterday in terms of wins, but he's still hanging on a lot of second places. States, though, are not delegates, and there's still a long road ahead to get to the 1,400 delegates needed to secure the nomination. So we want to hear from those of you in the states that have yet to vote, from people who will soon be casting their ballots in the upcoming Republican primaries. We want to know how Super Tuesday hit you and affected you. Did the results change anything for you? Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to talk@npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. So, Ken, why was Ohio so important yesterday?
Well, it had the most delegates for certain. It was nobody's home territory. For example, Massachusetts and Vermont was Romney country. Georgia was Gingrich country. Basically, it was like it was in the key Midwest. Everybody likes to say that no Republican has ever been elected president without winning Ohio. Mm. Of course, that's in the general election, not in the primary. But it was thought to be an even Steven match. Santorum had the religious conservatives. Romney had the establishment support. Rob Portman, former senator, George Voinovich and others and like that. So a lot of money was poured into it, and by far it had the most delegates.
Let's listen to the winner by one percentage point.
To the millions of Americans who look around and can only see jobs they can't get and bills that they can't pay, I have a message. You have not failed. You have a president that's failed you, and that's going to change.
So Ken, Mitt Romney making it sound like he doesn't run against Republicans from this point forward. He's only running against the Democrat in the White House.
He's done that from almost the day one, although once his super PACs and his campaigns within the state are savaging his opponents. But on election night, unlike Gingrich last night in Atlanta, and to some extent Rick Santorum as well, Mitt Romney focused on President Obama, the eyes on the prize, which is beating Obama in November. Now, it's interesting. He won 6 out of 10 primaries, and that doesn't sound like a great victory, but 4 years ago on Super Tuesday, John McCain won 9 out of the 21 states. Mm-hmm. I mean, he lost 12 states, and yet basically the race was over as of then. So it's very interesting, the different perceptions of what defines a victory.
I want to ask you about the tone we're about to hear. Rick Santorum was also in Ohio when he got the results, and he also made the point of his speech, the president, the man in the White House right now, and here's the tone he took.
This is the beginning of the end of freedom in America. Once the government has control of your life, then they got you.
I'm just thinking the balloons falling in the confetti and the podium and the atmosphere, it doesn't sound like a triumphant moment. It sounds very, very somber. Is that typical of Santorum in a moment like this?
Well, no. I mean, when he wins, when he won those three states on February 7th, he was more magnanimous and more festive. But, you know, according to the Santorum campaign, it was a victory in the sense that he got outspent 4-1 in a big state like Ohio, and he only lost by one percentage point. The obverse of that, of course, is that a week ago he had a huge lead, or a sizable lead, over Mitt Romney, and Romney, by spending, by campaigning, and by telling Republicans, look, we need to win in November, and that's the real issue. Romney had that comeback.
Let's talk about Newt Gingrich. He bet everything on Georgia. It wasn't a very risky bet, or was it?
Well, you never know. I mean, you never know what's going to happen in these things, of course. But out of the 21 contests we've had so far, Newt Gingrich has only won two states, mm-hmm. the South Carolina primary on January 21st, and now yesterday in his home state of Georgia. Next week, there are two more primaries in the South, Alabama and Mississippi. And again, if Newt Gingrich is going to be competitive, if he has a chance at this nomination, he's got to – I mean – you know, we've counted out Newt Gingrich so many times. We counted him out during the summer. We counted him out when he lost in Iowa and all these things. But if he doesn't win Alabama, Mississippi, and certainly if Rick Santorum wins it, it's hard to make the case that Gingrich has anywhere else to win, because this should be Gingrich country.
What do you think are the deciding issues in those two states?
Well, who is the true conservative? You know, obviously Gingrich, he's been served in Congress for so many years, and he had strong support in Georgia. He had the endorsement of Governor Nathan Deal. He had a lot of Georgia support there. Herman Cain from Georgia was a big influence in that state. But, you know, whether it's we're talking about regionalism or not, and Newt Gingrich coming from the South, or the evangelical vote, which seems to be going towards Rick Santorum. Of course, Mitt Romney would love for the two of them to keep fighting it out and splitting the right-wing vote to help Romney, but I suspect that Santorum or Gingrich is going to be the strong one in those two southern states.
Okay, we're talking to political junkie Ken Rudin. It's also your chance to talk with him and share with him and me your insights on this. How did the Super Tuesday primary affect you if you're in a state that has yet to vote? Do you pay attention? Are you influenced? Does a winner get does somebody come out strong and you think you see a winner and it changes your view or not, or you stick to your original position? We're going to go now to Tim in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. Thanks.
It has not changed. Well, actually, I don't know who I'm going to vote for. I was not impressed with the results in Ohio because when I look closely at those results, there are over 80-something counties in Ohio, and actually Rick Santorum won well over 70 of those, and many of those by a landslide, 8, 9, 10%. So I'm not confident that either one is a viable candidate, really.
So if one or the other had emerged very, very clearly as the winner, would that have influenced who you vote for? In other words, would you be going with the winner?
I think so. You know, if Romney could have solidified his candidacy, perhaps I'd feel more strongly about that. Mm-hmm. But, you know, with the mixed results, and especially the Ohio results, where although he's barely won by popular vote, he didn't come anywhere close to winning, you know, a plurality, I guess you would say, of the counties. And, in fact, just the opposite. In fact, I think he lost Ohio because he couldn't carry 70 of the 80-something counties in Ohio. So, you know, he is not this great big winner on Super Tuesday as far as I'm concerned.
Tim, let me tell you why I disagree with you. Because if you look at, for example, the map of Pennsylvania and the presidential race, if the Republican candidate always cleans up an overwhelming majority of the counties in the middle of the state and in most of the state. But as long as the Democrats pull up huge pluralities in Philadelphia in the east and Pittsburgh in the west, they'll win the state. And if you look at the map of the 2000 map, I mean, George W. Bush won far more counties than Al Gore, but because Al Gore did so hugely well in states like New York and California and Illinois, he won the popular vote. So it's really not about counting the counties, it's about counting the votes. And so, like I say, a win is a win is a win, and that's why I think Romney deserves.
I guess I'm looking at his broad support among Republicans, and he better be thankful that Romney was in, that Gingrich and Paul were in the race, because I think if not, Santorum probably would have won Ohio outright, as well as several of the other states.
Interesting point. What do you think of that, Ken?
That's a very interesting point indeed, and it reminds me, as everything does, of the past. 1976, you had five liberals running against Jimmy Carter in New Hampshire. If one of them, Birch Bayh, Fred Harris, Sergeant Shriver, dropped out, perhaps Mo Udall could have beaten him for the primary, but because there were so many liberals running, the centrist Jimmy Carter won it. But I think, Tim, you make a very good point. Had there been one-on-one, it could have been a different answer.
Thanks for your call, Tim. We're going to go next to Tom in Portland, Oregon. Tom, hi. You are on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. How are you this morning?
We're great. Thanks.
This weekend we had the Dorchester Conference in Oregon, which is a sort of a recreational politics for committed moderates and conservatives. Romney took 52%, so I think he's going to clear the primaries handily out here on the left coast. And so the question remains, can he get more than 29% in Portland? If he does that, then he could conceivably take Oregon.
And are you going to vote? Are you taking part in the primary?
Oh, yes.
And did Super Tuesday affect your thinking on this?
No, not really.
No? Your mind was
no. You have to look at the candidates and the population here. There's nobody really that appeals to the more liberal Republicans better than Romney does. And the other thing is we have a high unemployment, so we're very concerned about the issue of jobs, and we're not getting them.
Tom, when you say you think Romney has a chance, are you talking about in the primary or the general election? Because in the general election, Oregon seems to be pretty much a Democratic state. But as you say, Oregon does have a history of electing moderate liberal Republicans like Mark Hatfield, Bob Packwood, things like that.
That is correct. And I think in the primary, he's a shoo-in. And in the general, like I said, I think he has to get more than 29%. Of Portland, because the rest of the state, other than Portland, Salem, and Eugene, the rest of the state is actually conservative. It's those three areas that change it. But those Oregonians tend to vote more independently. I worked for Mark Hatfield, and so I got to see that again and again and again.
All right, Tom, thanks very much for your call. You know, Ken, something we need to talk about is Dennis Kucinich. Is it the end of the story of Dennis Kucinich?
Well, who knows? I mean, you know, like Newt Gingrich, we count him out so many times. He ran for president twice. I think he ran for the House five times or four times, Dennis Kucinich did, before he was finally elected to Congress in 1996, I think. But here's the thing.
First, what happened to him yesterday?
Well, he lost overwhelmingly to Marcy Kaptur. This is one of like 13 races, or 12 races in the country where an incumbent will run against a fellow incumbent because of redistricting. Mm-hmm. And her Toledo district in the north and Dennis Kucinich's district of western Cleveland were merged. Most of the money and most of the geography went to Kaptur, who is the most senior woman in the House. She was first elected in 1982. She won pretty overwhelmingly, but there's a silly rumor, or let's just say it's a rumor, going around that because Dennis Kucinich was looking once upon a time at Washington State at an open congressional seat, people are saying, well, the deadline to move to Washington is April 18th. The deadline to file a candidacy is May 18th. Dennis Kucinich could theoretically move to Washington State and run for Congress. But then again, theoretically, I could be elected president of the United States.
Well, I mean, how make-believe is that story?
Well, I don't know. His staff has not ruled it out. But, of course, the Democrats in Washington State said, look, we have enough candidates. I don't think we need somebody from Cleveland coming in, but it's out there.
All right.
Let's and if it's out there, I say it.
Mike in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. Mike, hi, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, thank you. I'm in Indiana, and I'm going to be supporting Ross Perot.
Ron Paul, let me guess.
Ron Paul.
Yeah.
You know, I want to
vote RP for factor.
That I think is best qualified for the job. You know, I saw exit polling data. It's my understanding that when Ross Perot ran, people asked if you thought he could win, mm-hmm. would you vote for him? And a majority of people said yes. I don't understand people who vote for candidates simply because they think they can win, not because they want that candidate to win.
I think that's a fair point, but at the same time, with 21 contests, Ron Paul still hasn't won anywhere. And, of course, his supporters are still committed. He still has strong backing from them. But aside from a bunch of second-place finishes, that's all he's got. He's a clear fourth in the number of delegates.
Yeah, but Ken, what's your argument to Mike not to vote his conscience, not to vote?
Well, no, I agree with that completely. To vote for somebody just because they think they can win takes away the emotion factor, and you really want to vote for somebody you believe in. And if you believe in Ron Paul, that's fine. That's absolutely fine. The question is, where does he go in November when it's an establishment Republican versus Barack Obama?
Right, Mike. That's a good question. Are you already thinking ahead to who you will vote for in November? Is it just the Republican, or does it depend on who it is?
It will depend on who it is, but since I know who the opponent's going to be, more than likely, you know, we fall in line. We don't fall in love. But I'm tired of that. You know, I want to fall in love again.
It's been a while?
Yes.
Yeah. All right, Mike, thanks very much for your call.
Thank you. You have a nice day.
You're listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR News. Let's bring in Russ in Salt Lake City. Hi, Russ. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. How are you guys?
We're great.
Hey, what does it say about Rick Santorum's executive and organizational ability if he can't even do the basic paperwork to get those counties, those delegates in Ohio, and even get on the ballot in Virginia when he needed that so desperately? You know, executive ability and organizational ability is needed by the leader of the free world in complex times, and I don't think Rick Santorum has got it. I think Mitt Romney's got that. And I don't think we've ever had a candidate available to us with such experience, intellect, and organizational and intellectual ability as Mitt Romney. I think he's the man.
Well, Russ makes a good point in the fact that not everybody knows this. Not only did Rick Santorum failed to get on the ballot in Virginia along with everybody else except Romney and Ron Paul, but there were three congressional districts in Ohio that Santorum couldn't qualify for delegates. So whether it's organization, whether it's money, clearly Romney leads in that category, and that's one of the reasons why he was on the ballot in every state and every congressional district, unlike Santorum.
But Russ, it sounds as though you measure that organizational ability. You take that organizational ability as a serious emblem of broader ability.
Well, you know, Romney has run two campaigns now in 2008 and 2012. And that's a difficult thing to do. I don't think people really appreciate how hard it is to hang in there the way Mitt and Ann Romney have through, you know, all the garbage and all the stuff, and still be positive, still be on message. It's an exhausting process, and it weeds out those who I don't think have the mettle and the ability to handle such a difficult job as chief executive of the United States.
You know, you mentioned that he ran, this is the second time he ran. It was 4 years ago, right after Super Tuesday, 2 days after Super Tuesday, that Mitt Romney dropped out of the race. And what he said was, look, I could keep going on and winning a victory here and there, but he didn't want to destroy the party's chances of beating either Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. And that's not something you're hearing from his opponents in 2012.
Yeah, very unselfish on his part. I think he's a smart man. And he's got what it takes to be a real leader. And I think that's what we need right now, is a real leader with smarts and skill and experience and ability. I don't know why we're looking anywhere else, frankly.
Russ, thanks very much for your call. Well, we're going to take a break now, but we are not done with Political Junkie yet. Ken Rudin is going to be staying with us, aren't you, Ken?
I think I am.
Yes. And when we come back, in a week when the president and several GOP contenders actually focused on a foreign policy question, Israel, we will too. We're going to talk about the politics of Israel, and we're going to change our question to you now. We want to hear from you whether or not Israel is for you a factor in deciding who you will place your vote for in the upcoming presidential election. So that's next. I'm John Donvan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. To be a politician and take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land. And take over this beautiful land. Well, right now it is Super Wednesday, and we're talking with political junkie Ken Rudin for the hour this week. And before everyone's attention turned to Ohio and the other Super Tuesday states, political watchers had been zeroed in on a convention center right here in Washington, D.C. for the annual AIPAC conference. AIPAC is the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, and it is seen as wielding considerable sway in U.S. politics. President Obama spoke at the conference Sunday, a day before he met in the White House with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. And yesterday, three of the four GOP candidates addressed the gathering. To some, Israel is the defining issue in an election, and for others, it actually hardly registers. We want to ask you, our listeners, that question. Does Israel actually affect the way you vote, or U.S. policy towards Israel affect the way you vote? Give us a call. Our number is 800-989-8255. Our email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. So Ken Rudin is here, and also joining us in Studio 3A is Robert Levinson. He is a senior defense policy analyst for Bloomberg Government and a former lobbyist for AIPAC. It's very nice, Robert, to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
So tell us the fact that both the president and then three of the four men who want to be in the White House make an effort and keep that appointment with AIPAC at a time like this. Tells us what about AIPAC?
Well, it is a fairly influential organization. You know, at their annual policy conference, they get, I think this year they had over 13,000 people there. And these are people who are energized about the Israel situation, Israel security, and these are politically active people. So it's a very much a lot of bang for the buck for both the president and people running who want to be the president to come and talk to this crowd.
And is AIPAC seen as the in American politics as the organization that speaks for American Jews when you consider that there are other groups trying very much to move into that area, such as J Street, which comes at it a little bit more from the left and is somewhat more critical of the Israeli government than AIPAC would be? Is AIPAC still the big dog on the block?
I think AIPAC is still the big dog on the block. I don't think anybody disputes that. I don't think J Street would dispute that. But they come at the questions a little bit more from the left. You have organizations on the right, too, the ZOA, the Zionist Organization of America, that are more to the right. But AIPAC is certainly still the sort of the big dog, the largest membership, probably the largest budget, and those kinds of things.
And when either the president or the men who want to replace him speak before AIPAC, are there just marks that they have to hit in their rhetoric? Are there things that they need to say or to be heard saying to be applauded by the crowd?
I think, yeah, they want to be heard saying that, you know, the security of Israel is important to the United States, that it's, you know, there's an unequivocal commitment by the United States to stand by the security of Israel and make sure that Israel is safe and secure, sort of above all else.
And there's no one who doesn't say that.
No, I mean, nobody's going to go before AIPAC and say anything otherwise. You notice that there were three of the four Republicans running. Ron Paul wasn't there, and he wouldn't say that if he were.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of what the president said and then what some of his opponents said. And I want to also bring in Ken Rudin to help parse a little bit whether there is much daylight between what the candidates are saying, because they're certainly making the case, certainly the Republicans are making the case that they offer Israel something that the president doesn't. But first, let's listen to what the president said on Sunday very briefly.
I've said that when it comes to preventing Iran from obtaining a nuclear weapon, I will take no options off the table. And I mean what I say.
All right, that's President Obama. Now, Mitt Romney, did he appear in person or did he? I believe he might have sent a
video. I think he was there via video.
Okay, and this is what Mitt Romney had to say.
As president, I'll be ready to engage in diplomacy, but I will be just as ready to engage our military might. Israel will know that America stands at its side in all conditions and in all consequence.
So, Ken Rudin, you know, what's the difference between what Mitt Romney said and the president said. Both of them, you could step very far back and say both of them are saying, I will stand by Israel and I will use what means I have to do that. Mitt Romney being more specific, the president saying all options. What's the difference?
Well, there may not be much difference in what we heard from Mitt Romney and the president just now, but we have heard people like Newt Gingrich saying that the United States has sold out Israel, sold out Netanyahu, and obviously Iran is one of the things that the Republican candidates are focusing on. Not so much softness on Israeli policy and Israeli defense, but softness on dealing with the Iranian threat. And I think I'd like to ask Rob the question. I mean, we always talked about how Israel was always democratic supporters, always pro-Israel people always voted Democratic, I guess going back to Harry Truman in 1948. But you see more and more Republicans stepping up, trying to win the Jewish vote. Is it about Israel security? Is it about painting Obama soft on Iran? What do you think the whole thing is?
Well, as you know, Ken, Jewish American voters are pretty reliably Democratic voters for the most part, and so it's a constituency that the Republicans have always tried to go after and try to nail down. And they have some success. There are certainly some very prominent Jewish Republicans, but when it comes to the voting booth, generally it doesn't change much, and they're pretty reliably Democratic. So they're looking for ways to woo that constituency. But the other thing you understand, outside of the people who maybe come to the AIPAC conferences, I think as you mentioned, John, Jewish voters have a whole host of issues that they're concerned about, and Israel fits into that milieu of things they consider, but it's not the only issue, and for many, it's not the prominent issue or the primary issue.
Let's go to some listeners now. I want to bring in Rachel in St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Rachel. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hello.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. I have to say that Israel will be a huge part of how I vote in this upcoming election. I am typically, like your AIPAC guest said, a Democratic voter. I've never voted Republican. However, I just cannot vote for Obama again, I don't think, based on his actions toward Israel, the way he's treated Netanyahu, you know, as far back as when Netanyahu came here and he put him in through the side door, didn't have dinner with him, and then his snafu with Sarkozy. I mean, it's just one thing after another. And while I think you asked Ken Rudin, you know, what's the difference between Romney and Obama,
yeah,
and what they
yeah.
said at AIPAC, well, Obama has actions behind his stance, and his actions do not match his words. He has not been supportive of Israel. He certainly has been, you know, along with Jimmy Carter, the least supportive of Israel. And just an example, asking the Israeli government to free settlements, which they did, asking the PA to give nothing, not to put down their arms, not to quit hurling rockets over into Israel proper. I mean, on and on and on. And then, which, you know, when Biden came to visit, the freeze was supposedly lifted because there was building in North Jerusalem, which, by the way, wasn't even part of the settlement freeze, asking for 67 borders. I mean, it goes on and on and on.
All
so right. I was just really quickly, I was just going to say,
no,
while I usually vote democratically, socially, pro-choice, pro-social welfare programs, this is really a sticking point for me.
Right.
I will probably be voting Republican.
So it weighs very, very heavily for you. Okay. Thanks very much, Rachel, for sharing that with us. I want to go to Billy in Charlotte, North Carolina. Hi, Billy. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Pleasure.
I do not see Israel as a need to sway my vote. Personally, I believe that this is a country right now that's coming close to being in shambles, and we shouldn't really be involved in somebody else's foreign affairs.
Can I ask you which country are you saying is in shambles? The U.S. or Israel?
America. I'm sorry.
Okay.
I should make that clear. Israel is one of the strongest militaries in the world, and I don't really think that America needs to get involved in their problems right now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if we're really worried about Iran gaining a nuclear weapon, and there's very little evidence saying that they do, why aren't we going after North Korea or China or any one of our enemies that already have weapons?
All right, Billy. Thanks very much for your comment. I want to bring in Ira in St. Pete, Florida. Hi, Ira, you're on Talk of the Nation.
Well, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I think that Rachel stated a lot of my issues quite well, but I find that not being a singular issue voter I have been also very unhappy with what the president has done. I think it was very appropriate when they say that world leaders don't all have to be best friends, but they certainly should behave in a fashion that's appropriate to their stature. And I don't think the president has done that when it comes to Israel. That's very offensive, considering that the Democratic Party does enjoy the Jewish vote and has traditionally done that. When it comes to looking at the options that are out there, and you look at people like Ron Paul, who has a very checkered history when it comes to issues that relate to the Jewish community, that definitely would eliminate him, I think, from most Jewish voters. But I don't think that's really an issue, because I don't think he'll really ever be reflective in this election in any real fashion.
Let me, Ira, and thanks very much for your call. I just want to ask Robert Levinson, because you go in and out of Israel. This perception that the president, I mean, two calls, literally, that the president is disrespectful of Netanyahu, Prime Minister Netanyahu, has snubbed him. Is that the perception in Israel broadly and deeply and permanently?
Well, I can't speak. You know, I haven't been to Israel too recently, mm-hmm. but I have seen recent polling which indicates that actually the majority of Israelis don't have so much of a problem with Barack Obama. You have to remember, Netanyahu definitely represents a constituency within Israel. He's the prime minister. But remember, his major opponent, Tzipi Livni, her party actually got more votes, more seats in the parliament in the last election. She wasn't able to form a coalition. It's a coalition government in the way it's a parliamentary system in Israel, so they form coalitions. So there's a substantial constituency in Israel that, you know, isn't necessarily with Netanyahu and everything. On the security issue, on the Iran issue, I think most of them are there. But some of these other issues, not so much.
And the callers, Rachel in particular, again, was talking very passionately about her distrust, I think, of President Obama's support for Israel. And I'm wondering, is that distrust something that is perceived there? And is there a litany of actions the president has actually taken? She mentioned a call to return to 67 borders, which is actually not very far from what George Bush held as a policy, and yet there's a perception that somehow President Obama means it in a different way.
Some of this, I think, is a product of tone rather than actual substance. You know, the president often will point to, you know, aid, U.S. military aid to Israel has gone up under his tenure. He's added funds from the Department of Defense on top of the foreign aid budget to pay for Israeli missile defense to protect him from the very rockets that Rachel mentioned from Gaza. He fought very hard against the Palestinian effort to be recognized as a state in the UN, and in fact, it appears that he forestalled that effort. So there's a lot of actions that he'll point to in his side of the ledger that he would say, show a different side.
All right. I want to thank Robert Levinson for joining us. He's a senior defense policy analyst for Bloomberg Government and a former lobbyist for AIPAC. Very good to have you on Talk of the Nation. And as always, Ken Rudin, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, John.
You are listening to Talk of the Nation on NPR News.